Welcome to the China MENA podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. An underlying theme in nearly every conversation we've had on this program has been security. The Middle East is a highly competitive region, and the role of extra-regional actors has always been a significant factor. As China's presence here grows, it's natural to think more about what kind of security role we can expect from Beijing. This leads to a lot of speculation, but not always informed or thoughtful analysis. Because of that, I'm happy to have with us today Colonel Dr. Asaf Haller and Dr. Sarah Masha-Feinberg. Asaf is Director of Research at Tel Aviv University's Elram Air and Space Research Center. Sarah is Senior Researcher and Head of the Great Powers Research Program, also at the Elram Air and Space Research Center, and she's also an Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University. Sarah and her colleagues Tomer Fadlan and Haim Schwartz have recently published a research report, China's Expanding Presence in MENA, Future Implications for the Air Domain. In it, they look deeply at how China's presence can affect the regional military operational environment. So we're going to get pretty deep into the security side of things today. Asaf, Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. So Asaf, we'll start with you. Your report focuses on the implications of China's presence in MENA, focusing specifically on the air domain. What was the impetus for this study?
First, I think it's important to understand what is the mission of our research center, which is not only an academic center, but also aims to influence decision makers and assist them by letting them have the wide picture and the future implications of the academic knowledge. Therefore, our mission is focusing not only on strategic level, but also on operational level. And this is why we're heading to this research. But for many years, China had a very low influence on what's going on in the Middle East. It had a very low impact on geopolitical issues. It had no military presence. It sold weapons, but the arms sales were usually limited to low-quality weapons and to niche markets. If you put aside what happened during the Iran-Iraq war, usually China was not a great supplier of weapons to any country in the Middle East. But recently we see a change, and we foresee that this change is going to continue and expand. First, China is involved in political issues. I think the most important example is the influence on the Saudi Arabia and Iran agreement recently, which put China in a very important place in the Middle East. Second, it seeks military presence in Djibouti, in Bab el-Mandab. They look for a ports in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf. We talk about the Shabahar port, and we see drills, naval drills, recently with Iran and Russia. The third point is military technology development in China. For many years, China had only low-level weapons, which were locally produced. Recently, it develops its own capabilities and weapon systems, highly sophisticated, which can be transferred to other countries. And we see that in the recent years, in the last decade, China became, I think, the fifth or sixth supplier to the Middle East. And finally, the growing tension in the Middle East between the superpowers, between China, the United States, and Russia, if you put aside, is giving a new dimension to the presence of China, as President Biden put it in his own words. There's a global conflict between the democracies and autocracies. Hence, the stories of Israel and Gaza, Ukraine and China and Taiwan are only parts of the same whole picture. All these points come together to a point where we see a potential for dramatic change in the presence of China in the Middle East. in several perspectives. First, the supply of better weapons, the supply of better military and dual use technologies, its military presence, and maybe in the future, military cooperation with states in the Middle East. The reason we took this project of describing what China is looking for in the Middle East is that we believe that Israel and the Israeli Air Force should take into account all these going on procedures that might influence the capabilities of Israel, the capabilities of the Israeli Air Force to operate freely in the Middle East in the next years. We don't think that China is an enemy of Israel, at least not for now. And I believe it's not going to be an enemy of Israel, but its influence on the air domain, military air domain, might put some limitations and restrictions upon Israeli capabilities. And this is why we took this project on us and decided to analyze. In Israel, it was the first project from of this type to analyze the operational implications of the Chinese presence in the Middle East.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think your last point, I mean, obviously you're looking at this from an Israeli perspective, but I think what's happening affects a lot of countries in the region. And it was interesting for me to see this report because I haven't seen too many countries or governments or militaries in the region that have really given it this level of thought or you know, kind of scenario planning. So I was happy to see it. I know that I talked to Sarah with you and some of your colleagues, I believe in mid-2022. And just thinking, Asaf, as you listed all of the changes that have happened over, say, from December 2022 until now, you've really had, you either look visionary or very, very lucky because a lot of stuff has happened to make your report a lot more, I think, important. Sarah, one of the things I really thought your team did a really good job of in this report is presenting China's strategic interests in a pretty clear and analytical way, looking both internationally and within this region. So how do you assess China's strategic interests internationally and in the Middle East? And how do you see the Middle East affecting China's broader goals for its international policy?
Well, Jonathan, this is a conversation we had together when we met some months ago. When we talk about China's strategic objectives, our challenge was to maintain a balance between two prevailing narratives. There is one narrative, and especially a Washington-focused narrative, that presents China's strategic horizon as driven by the ambition of challenging or undermining the U.S. hegemony, not only in the Indo-Pacific, but globally and including in the Middle East. And side by side, you have a lenient narrative or moderate view of China that sees its expansion, including its military and security-related expansion, as a way to safeguard its expanding economic and commercial interests. So our challenge for Asaf, Tomer, and Chaim and me was to really try to strike a balance between those clearly opposing and even opposite views of what China is trying to achieve. If we look at the global level, of course, China is embarked on a national rejuvenation journey that tries to restore and preserve its position as a world power. Of course, China is driven by the need to safeguard its maritime rights and interests, especially in the South China Sea, and to maintain a balanced economic growth and support a sustainable development of its country. And those global interests are go side in side with what we call the PLA Goes Global, this new ambition of the PLA to become a world-class expeditionary force expeditionary force by the middle of the 21st century. And of course, those global objectives do shape China's strategy in the Middle East. China's strategy, and we talked about this, Jonathan, with you, appears to be mainly driven by energy interests. We know that half of China's oil imports come from the Middle East, and some 25% of its consumed oil imports. So this is a first and foremost objective. Another one is about, of course, developing growing markets and economic partnerships, especially with the GCC countries, but also with the countries in North Africa, in Egypt, and also with Turkey. A third main objective, and I think it is an objective that needs to be connected to China's military expansion in the area, is the need to secure the freedom of navigation along MENA's sea lane. It is vital for China to secure the sea lines of communication in the region. Of course, the Strait of Hormuz between the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman, and the Suez Canal and Bab el-Mandab in the Red Sea. And in this context, we've seen an increasing Chinese presence in the West, in the Red Sea, that is connected to its larger ambition to become the greatest power in Africa, on the African continent. And of course, the Red Sea is a key gateway to Africa. An additional interest is of course, the ambition of increasing its influence in the Middle East, and to gaining the diplomatic and political support from as many states as possible. In this regard, China has pursued an everyone's friend policy, including with Iran and Israel and the Gulf states and Iran, this sort of balancing approach that enables it to gain as many political and diplomatic dividends as possible. China has tried to fashion itself as a neutral mediator also in the region. We should add to that China's interest to observe and sometimes control the rise of Islamic Jihad, and that is connected to China's Uyghur problem. We know that before the October 7th, China raised grave concern about the rise of Islamic jihadism in the region. And the final goal is to really undermine or challenge the US presence in the area by consolidating its alliance with Russia and Iran, but at the same time, maintaining this challenge under certain thresholds. The idea for China, in our view, is to maintain a sufficient US presence to guarantee the security, stability, and predictability of our region, to safeguard China's commercial and economic interests. I would like to make a last point, Jonathan. We are in the midst of the Hamas-Israel war, and we've seen a change in China's policy, whether it's a strategic reorientation of China towards Russia and Iran and Israel's enemies or not, is yet to be seen. But we've seen a clear official siding with Russia, Iran, and the Palestinian cause. We didn't see any condemnation of Hamas. Hamas is not designed as a terror organization. And we've seen China trying to navigate through the complex web of alliances it has developed in the Middle East with countries that are both anti-Israel and anti-American, like Iran, countries that are pro-American and anti-Israel, like Saudi Arabia, and countries that are pro-American and not openly anti-Israeli. So China has tried to navigate through this complex environment since October 7th. In parallel, we've seen the Chinese regime enabling and sometimes encouraging an unprecedented anti-Semitic campaign on social media, which has raised alarms in Israel, and Israel feels alienated by China. China in particular has been extremely in the social media. Chinese bloggers have been extremely aggressive towards, you know, for example, Chinese hostages like Noah Agamani, one of our young hostages that is held by Hamas. And that has received thousands of speech hatred comments. And we've seen this de facto institutionalized anti-Semitic campaign on social media, which has raised concern and raises the question of whether China has reoriented itself, vis-à-vis Israel, and has is questioning the former balancing act it tried to preserve in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's interesting. We did a show about Israeli perspectives about China's response to October 7th in November with Gedalia Aftermann. And we talked about this a lot. And I think a lot of China's response is, you brought up that point about China's approach to the region, saying that they're trying to, on the one hand, trying to wedge regional actors away from, create wedges between regional actors and the U.S., but at the same time, realizing that this U.S. security umbrella is really important for China's interests here. So how do you maintain that? And that's a pretty tough needle to thread. And I think when China looks at the Israel-Palestine conflict, I imagine for decision makers in Beijing, where most, you know, there's very, very, very minuscule Israeli or Arab representation in China. These people don't have any kind of political voice. It's not like in the US or Europe or Canada, where we have huge Arab populations and huge Jewish populations that feel very strongly about this issue, making it important to our politics. In China, it's not important. There's no, you know, lobbying group of Arab Muslims or you know, Chinese Jews who are going to Beijing and complain to the government. So I think it becomes a purely a geopolitical issue. And they think, look, if they have this kind of narrow vision of the Arab world, thinking, you know, all Arab countries have the same perspective on Palestine, which I think is not true, all they have to do is work with or give rhetorical support to Palestine and then get all of these Arab League states to support China in international fora like the UN. And then they think, well, Israel is never going to be split from the US, so it doesn't cost us anything, right? So I think it's a very kind of pure realpolitik approach to an issue. And I think what it's really shown a lot of folks in the region is China's not really that definitive an actor on the most consequential issues here, which has been kind of interesting, I think, given all the hype we've seen over the past 2 years.
Yeah, I just want to add to this that as opposed to the European countries, China doesn't have any ethical considerations, you know, when it comes to bombing the Gaza Strip. And it's a pure realpolitik position. But at the same time, it has used for internal purposes. We've seen the Chinese campaign in the informational space, you know, presenting the barbaric Israeli bombings in the Gaza Strip in order to whitewash what China is doing with the Uyghur community. You know, so this is also, it does have also an international and a domestic purpose. I also want to add to that, that at the operational level, China didn't do anything, meaning that it's a very, you know, cost-free way of gaining support, of consolidating its base in the Arab world, but with no action indeed. So that's also a very Chinese approach to it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to come back to the report. I'm sure everything will, you know, all of these issues get caught up in the analysis of everything we talk about here. But just you mentioned a point, Sarah, about the competing narratives, you know, and this is something I think China does. One of the first books one of the most significant books I read when I was doing my PhD was Cultural Realism by this guy at Harvard, Alistair Ian Johnson, saying, you know, Chinese tend to see themselves in purely defensive. You know, strategically, historically, we've always been a very peaceful, you know, Confucian society. We're not interested in war or conquest. At the same time, you know, this other narrative looking at, you know, centuries of warfare and conquest and expansion of the states. So I think that's true of most places, right? Like we talk about the security dilemma in my intro to IR classes and how countries always think they're acting defensively. So, you know, these different narratives, the defensive posture and the aggressive expansionism, I think is, you know, it makes it really hard for people to think very clearly about China. Cause if you have one or the other, driving your thinking, it kind of gets hard to get inside of that box. So Asaf, I think in this report, it does a good job of acknowledging the importance or the, you know, just how much international narratives about China are driven by these different frameworks. But I think everybody made a pretty good effort to not use it to shape the analysis. Can you explain why you made that choice? Did you come into the study with any preconceived notions about the expansion of Chinese power and influence in MENA?
First, I hope we're not preconceived. You know that every analyst hopes that even it can recognize the potential biases and get along with it. And usually analysts believe that they can cope with this bias and give an unbiased analysis. Well, first, I can say that we tried not to be preconceived. But I think that there's something else, and it is part of the methodology of the research. From a strategic point of view, if you are a strategist who tries to plan your strategy coping with China, it is very important to understand what is the Chinese strategy. If there are two very different narratives, it is really hard to develop a strategy that copes with both of them. But we do not look in this research on the strategic level per se. We tried to get into the operational perspective. And I believe, this is an assumption of the analysis, that if you look at the operational point of view, from the operational point of view, it is less important what is the real strategy of China, because the implications, if I look at it from a very broad perspective, will look much the same. If we put aside, of course, the possibility that Israel and China will confront directly in the future, what happened in the past, 50 years ago, a little bit more than 50, Israeli forces and Russian forces in the Middle East really fought one against the other. But if we put aside this possibility and we assume that China will not be an enemy, direct enemy of Israel, I think that if we look at the potential implications of both strategies from the operational point of view, for example, arms sales, transfer of technology, military presence, and even to some extent, intel cooperations or military cooperations of China and the Middle East, the outcomes will look much the same. If at least in the first steps until China will have enormous bases in the Middle East and will cooperate with states. In the first steps of Chinese presence, I think that from operational point of view, things will look the same. We will have to cope with the potential arms sales, which can be part of either strategy. We'll have to cope with the potential of high-tech technology transfers to the Middle East. I think that even if you look at drills of China and Iran, China and Russian naval drills in the Middle East, you can find them in both strategies. On one side, the narrative of the expansionism, on the other side, the ambition of China just to protect its commercial routes. I think that our methodology helped us to put aside this dilemma and overcome it without the necessity to decide which is the real strategy of China.
Yeah. Okay. Sarah, coming back to you, I think when I was reading the report, when I got to chapter four, to me, this was the good stuff. Because again, like I said, there's a lot of people speculating about China's security role or what we think will China's security role will be, but it's really, really politicized. It's an issue that people feel very, very strongly about, and they don't always go too deeply into it. So in this report, you put together a really good overview of what China's doing in the region and security terms. Asaf mentioned a little bit in his first answer, but how do you assess China's security role in the region today?
Look, Jonathan, China's security role in the region at this moment is minimal. Hmm. It's negligible compared, you know, to the United States and Russia, maybe even France and Italy, in terms of military presence, in terms of arms sales, in terms of security cooperation and agreements. You know, China doesn't have any alliances in the region, real alliances, but there are four main sectors in which China has significantly expanded its presence since the 2010s and that do have security implications. You know, first, the expansion of civilian infrastructure, whether ports, industrial parks, smart cities. Second, tech transfers to MENA countries, including dual-use technology, including cyber capabilities and space capabilities, new technologies. The third sector is arms transfers, and we'll come back to this. And the fourth one is, of course, an expanding defense cooperation with MENA countries. I'd like to first highlight the issue of civilian infrastructure. I know, Jonathan, you wrote a lot about these issues, and especially the industrial park and ports connectivity. What is amazing is to see that there's been a tremendous expansion of China's construction of civilian infrastructure since 2013. You know, China has established over 200 large-scale infrastructure and energy projects in the region. And we see that actually the Mediterranean space is the second largest region or most concentrated region of Chinese infrastructure after the Indian Ocean. So that's already an interesting point. So why do we have a concern? The first concern is that, of course, China could leverage its civilian presence, its economic investments in infrastructure, and in particular commercial ports, as a soft security inroad in the region. And I think this is a concern that is increased by two dimensions. First of all, the Chinese concept of MCF, the military civilian or civil fusion, this idea that you develop your capabilities and you expand your presence by this merging of military and civilian elements. And the second concern rises from the gap between the new mandates that the PLA received to expand its presence overseas and beyond, of course, the South and East China Seas, and the real and actual infrastructure that China has at the moment. So basically, and this is a point that is being made by Isaac Carden, basically China is developing civilian strategic structures or nodes across the globe that could be used for civilian, but also for military purposes. The second concern, and here we're talking mainly about maybe an Israeli point of view, is that this development, this expansion of civilian infrastructure, owned and operated by China, does create new constraints for the air forces operating in the area. You know, those air forces will be compelled to consider Chinese interests during the operational planning and maybe in times of war. So this is also a big concern. Now let's talk about the technology transfers to MENA countries. Of course, we know that from a US perspective, the communication and digital technology stuff is a huge issue. But I'll talk more from a regional perspective and more from an Israeli perspective. First of all, of course, we have the problem of space technology. You know that China has considerably expanded its cooperation in space and space technology with key actors in the area, with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, but also with Iran. And just to make one point that is might be problematic is that Iran, for example, has received access to a China BDU-2 systems in 2021, making it only one of the two countries in the world with such access, the other being Pakistan. And as we know, the BDU-2 systems, which is the competitor to the GPS systems, can significantly enhance the accuracy, effectiveness, and lethality of missiles and drones. So that's another issue. The third domain that is problematic is tech cooperation. First of all, the concern, you know, connected to the dual use technology that is being given with the potential military applications, the transfer of communication technologies that might boost the recipient's surveillance capabilities. But most importantly, what is of concern is China's practice of not only providing key technologies, but providing the production know-how and capabilities. And that is a major concern, you know, from an Israeli point of view, that China is giving, is enhancing the capabilities of regional actors to self-produce the technology that China is developing, for example, the combination of drones and AI. And this is a major concern. With regards to the arms transfers, of course, China is focused on niche markets, mainly on UAVs. And of course, China has leveraged, you know, the regional actors' need to replenish their arsenal in drones. And they know that the United States is not very excited about giving drones to regional actors. So there's been a combination of interests. So we've seen a dramatic increase in China's exports of drones to the area. And that raises a few operational concerns. The first one is that despite of the limited scope and the low quality, Chinese arms exports have dramatically increased the number of drones and missiles and artillery systems in that area. So the concern is mainly quantitative, meaning that the resources and the attention that the air forces would like to address to concentrate on other issues will have to be relocated or transferred to the drone issue. So it takes away from some resources from the air forces operating in the area. And the second point is that Chinese exports, as I've mentioned before, will boost and diversify the force buildup of the regional countries, including of Israel's enemies and adversaries, again, by transferring the products, but also the technologies. I would like to end with the increased defense cooperation with MENA countries. We've seen a rise in partnership agreements. We don't know exactly what is the exact commitment of China, you know, to provide what it committed to providing to the GCC countries and to Iran. You know, a case in point is the strategic cooperation deal that was signed with Iran over 25 years. There's a lot of questions and speculations regarding the content of those cooperation agreements. But what we see is that we have an expanding a scope of defense cooperation with the GCC countries and with Iran that is also raising concerns. The last point is about the military basing. There's a lot of talks about Djibouti and its operational implications, but there's also a lot of concerns about the expansion of China's military basing. We've talked together, Jonathan, about the speculation over the establishment of a military base in the UAE, but you have a lot of concerns about the expansion of military bases in the Middle East and in other areas, which also would boost China's military presence in that area in the near future.
Mm. So much in that. And one thing when you're talking about the Beidou satellites, there's a really good book, I think from last year, maybe the year before, called Surveillance State. And I can't remember the author's names, but there are a couple of reporters of the Wall Street Journal. And they're talking about how a lot of the smart city technology and the satellite technology that China is exporting is often seen in a very, you know, useful, you know, we can use this technology to help you develop your economic capacity in your state, and we can use it for really peaceful purposes and advancing your development. But you can also use it for some really shady stuff that causes a lot of problems too, right? So the dual purpose of this is something that doesn't always get talked about a whole lot. And it's interesting because as a Western liberal, you know, when I'm talking to people from the Canadian or the American embassies or whatever, we'll often talk to people from the region and say, do you have any qualms about how this stuff can be used? Because we clearly would in our societies. And they say, no, we don't. We actually find this can be quite useful for a lot of what we're trying to achieve. For the cooperation agreements, I agree there's a lot of curiosity about what's in these things. I've read a lot about them. And I've read a lot of the public-facing statements about this is what the China-Saudi, you know, comprehensive cooperation agreement is. And most of it is very bland in general, saying all this is a commitment to cooperate on stuff of mutual interest. In anything that we, you know, any areas where we diverge, we're just going to put this on the back burner and come back to it later when we build up trust in political capital and other stuff. So there's typically not very much quantifiable in it. You know, like when you see the report about the Iran one being $400 billion, you know, China hasn't given anybody anything close to that much money in you know, since well before 2017. So it seemed to me that that was more of a wish list from Tehran saying, this is the stuff we want, and this is the stuff we hope China will give us. And, you know, a lot of the leaks, a lot of the quantifiable leaks about that partnership, I think, came out of Tehran. I think China immediately backed up and said, hey, we didn't say any of that stuff. So I think we have to take a lot of them with a grain of salt. But Asaf, I'd like to come back to the points I was talking about with just the tech cooperation and how this impacts the air domain, because I think this is where it gets really interesting to me as a non-specialist. It gives me a lot to think about. So can you just give us a brief overview of how you see this tech cooperation with China affecting specifically the air domain for regional militaries or regional governments?
Yes, and I'll continue from where Sarah just mentioned the quantitative perspective. The fact that they sell a lot of weapons or weapon systems that are not usually the most sophisticated. But on the other side, we must remember that the military air domain always was, and I believe always will be, very high tech. Air dominance is usually connected to technological dominance. And if you control the technology, you can better control the air. And what we've seen in China in the several last decades is a tremendous change. In the past, China bought weapon systems from the Soviet Union and they locally produced it, and then they began cloning systems. But this was in the past. In the last decade or last two decades, China began developing its own technological capabilities. For example, they are much better than Russia. For example, today they have fifth-generation aircrafts. The Russians don't really have such aircrafts. They produce new radars, ASA radars, seekers, anti-satellite systems, etc. And they have a very good military technologies, but not only. They also control what Sarah called dual-use technologies, such as producing computer chips and communications and satcoms and artificial intelligence and quantum technologies. All these can be used, as you mentioned, for military use. And what I'm think you should take into consideration is that the transfer of such technologies from China to the MENA region can help states here in the regions produce much better weapon systems. And I think the most bold example is Iran. Iran has an exceptional industry for weapons. They're really good at it. And they can produce various systems. They are very good inventors. They manage to find solutions to difficult problems. And with the assistance of high-tech Chinese capabilities, they can move much farther and much in a much rapid pace than in the past. I think this is the most challenging, if we talk about the air domain, not only the supplying of Chinese systems, but the supplying of Chinese technologies, which will help the Iranians run much faster in this game. We use the phrase qualitative military edge to describe the capability to have a better technologies, better capabilities over your opponent. And this is a very important part of the Israeli perspective of its posture in the Middle East. And I think that the transferring of Chinese technology, which can be used as part of weapon systems produced in the Middle East, might harm this qualitative military edge, which today is based upon Israeli capabilities and U.S. Capabilities that are sold to Israel. When we see the gap between Western technologies and Chinese technologies become narrower, I think that this might harm this qualitative military edge. I think this is something that should be taken into account both by Israel and the U.S. in this area.
While I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, you know, this podcast isn't one that people should be listening to if they want to feel better about the future. Where every episode, I feel like we're saying, like, go find a picture of a kitten or go hug a baby or something. But you know, they're all really good points. Especially, I tend to underplay what China does with Iran just because the point you make that Iran has a very good indigenous capacity for developing a lot of stuff, but you know, the tech that China's providing for other sectors, of course, it's all dual purpose. So it does really change the landscape in a lot of other ways. Sarah, we'll wrap up, and I'd like to ask each of you, but I'll ask you first, Sarah. How should regional governments and folks working in regional security issues be thinking about a greater Chinese presence? Not just in terms of the threats, but, you know, are there opportunities for regional actors as well?
So I'd let Asaf discuss the opportunities. Maybe we'll start with the threats to finish on an optimistic note.
Right.
I mean, in terms of thinking, I think there are three narratives that we showed that regional governments and also global powers like the United States should have in mind. The first story is about the fact that China's imprint on MENA's strategic architecture will become more significant in the coming decade. You know, out of a series of factors, you know, China, Russia being bogged down in Ukraine, and China developing its relationship with the regional actors, and the regional actors having greater strategic autonomy. You know, so there's a lot, you have a lot of factors that lead us to think that China's security imprint is here to stay and is here to grow Okay. The second story is the story about China's great transition, you know, of the 20th century from the Cold War era to now. You've seen a China producing, you know, low quality domestic production with a high dependency on imported advanced technology, you know, basically using outdated Soviet stuff, to now developing a domestic production characterized by increasingly advanced weaponry. And actually, China is taking the lead in several key sectors that will shape the face of 21st century warfare. And the third story is about the combination of China's advances in technology and weapon systems in key attractive sectors that will lead 21st century warfare, you know, Russia's depleted defense industry and export capabilities, China's intensifying connections with the MENA states. And we have to see whether China will go further and further towards Iran and Russia in our turbulent region, and Beijing's limited self-restraints when it comes to arms and tech transfers. So all of this together, you know, point to a high potential for wide-scale and higher quality Chinese technology and arms transfers to regional actors in the foreseeable future. So this is the story of the coming decades in our perspective. And in order to understand this story, I think the right approach, and we are not China experts, we're working for a center that specializes in air and space studies. The right approach is to try to really disconnect the strategic dimension of China's presence with the operational one. The idea is to look at what China does, not what China says or what China wants. And that's the main perspective that regional actors should maintain, you know, on China. Asaf.
Well, Sarah, let me talk about the opportunities. And unfortunately, I can and talk a little bit about opportunities, but I really see basically more and more threats. Mm-hmm. I think if you try to look at from the positive point of view, I think that China might play as a mediator in the Middle East for solving conflicts, for example. I think that if you look at Chinese money, it can be invested in improving infrastructures in places where people really suffer these days in the Middle East. There are many places like that. And Chinese money can do some good things for the people here, peoples in the Middle East. But unfortunately, I think that increase in Chinese presence in this decade occurs in the time where global conflicts between East and West is rising. And if we take this into account, we might understand that the involvement of China will wear more military uniforms than suits in the near future, simply because this is what's happening globally. Maybe 10 years ago, if China had come here to the Middle East, we might see a different Chinese behavior. But I'm afraid that a lot of the money and influence will go into military issues. And it means some things for us, for Israel. I think not only in Israel, but many other players in the region. First, we must not put a blind eye on the Chinese influence, potential influence. It's not only strategic influence, it is also operational influence. We should take it into account. And to put an eye on the Chinese presence here, especially, I think, when we talk about technology, which is very hard to track. It's more easy to track the arms sales than transferring of codes, for example. And to look at military cooperations or future possible military cooperations and intel cooperation between China and local players. And finally, I think that players from the West side might act together and find solutions together to this challenge. It's something that every state on its own cannot find a solution to. Nowadays, we see in the Middle East two coalitions beginning to form. The coalition headed by Iran with the support of Russia and maybe China, and the US-led coalition, at least what the US plans to create in the Middle East. And I think that these coalitions, it will force countries to choose side. And after a country chose side, I think the countries on the, what you call the good side, should act together. Because the potential threat of Chinese involvement is tremendous.
Well, I gave you the chance to wrap us up on a positive note. But
sorry.
You know what? I think a realistic note is more important than a positive one sometimes. And I appreciate it. I think you've both given us a good dose of realism, a lot to think about. I don't know if your report is available to the public, but I certainly do hope that that you get in front of as many eyes as possible, because I thought it was quite useful. I think other governments in the region would benefit from a similar type of analysis, and I hope you get a chance to brief some folks for this. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. And thank you to our listeners.
Yeah, you too. To the listeners, thanks for joining us again, and we look forward to seeing you next episode. We've got a great episode lined up. I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. Make sure you like, listen, subscribe, and all that other good podcast stuff, and we'll see you all soon. Thank you.